World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. Old soldiers advise young soldiers never to volunteer for anything. Jonathan, known as Jack Treadray, ignored that advice and, on volunteering, found himself dispatched to operations behind enemy lines as a commando with the Z Special Unit, highly trained in unarmed combat, weaponry and sabotage. He served under Major Tom Harnett Harrison, a British officer in command of clandestine operations against elements of the Japanese forces in Borneo. Warrant Officer Jack Treadray was awarded the Military Medal, and ever since, his has been a name revered among people of the Borneo Highlands. He'd still been leading raids in mid-October 1945, 2 months after Japan surrendered, simply because no one had told him the war was over. It was all a dramatic shift from his civilian training at a firm of gentlemen's tailors in Adelaide.
I went to Norwood School and left the day I turned 14.
Right. You didn't like it very much, or what were the reasons?
No, I got myself a job at Adelaide's number one tailor. I started there as the message boy and retired 55 years later as the owner.
Having had a few adventures in between, we'll hear about those. What was the name of that tailor's?
Flair, F-L-E-H-R, and Company.
Flair and Company, and they were established where, Jack? Where were they established in town?
In Gawler Place.
Thank you. Yeah. So you began as an office boy, and this is going back to the 1930s. I guess it was just after the Depression. You were probably very glad to get a job. Yep. When did you actually turn your hand to a bit of tailoring yourself?
At that time, jobs weren't easy to find, and my uncle was a hairdresser, a man's hairdresser, alongside of Flair's, and he used to cut their hair. And they told him one day they were looking for a young man. And he said, I've got a nephew I think would suit you. And that's how I got started.
That's excellent. And from being office boy, you went up to be trained as a tailor. They took you on as an apprentice tailor, did they?
No. Actually, I started off as the message boy. I went a salesman. I then went from salesman to drafting and that type of thing. My master, Dolph Schehinger, taught me cutting, fitting, everything, and I eventually took over the firm. When I turned 18, yep, I decided to join the CMF, the Citizens Military Forces. Yep. I joined that at 18, and I was a sergeant when war broke out, so my older brother immediately went from CMF to AIF, and I wanted to do the same thing, but my mother said, no, one's enough at the moment. Our father had died quite young, and she said, you hang off for a while. So it was probably 2 years before she allowed me to join the AIF.
So you transferred to the AIF, and that was 1942, I believe.
Yeah.
So you'd had some experience, CMF. You had sergeant rank, You'd achieved some rank in the CMF.
Yes, I'd got the sergeant, and as immediately I joined AOF, I became a private.
Exactly.
Yes, and I had to work up again.
Okay.
And I retired from the AOF as a WO2.
Exactly. Your first unit then in the AIF, where did you go first of all in your AIF service?
You mean in where I served?
Where you started out, before Z Special, where you started out with the AIF?
Oh, actually I served at two or three country areas. I joined the medical unit. And so I finished up at Mount Gambier. And it was from Mount Gambier that I got the opportunity to join Zed.
Right, so you're in the medical corps? Are you orderly, or what were you? What was your job, particular job in the medical corps?
Just running an RAP.
Right. Regimental Aid Post.
Yeah. Okay.
And then how did you hear about Zed Special?
A notice went up on the notice board at Gawler, and an officer would be attending looking for six people to join a special unit, and I was first in line.
Yes.
And the officer doing the talking, I looked at him and I thought, this is going to be good for me. It was Burston, Dr. Burston, later Sir Burston. And he looked at me and he said, where have we met? And I said, where did you get that uniform you're wearing? Good God, he said, the young man from my tailors. I was number one chosen.
Sir Samuel Burston, was that him?
Yes.
Okay, famous man.
Yeah, Sir Samuel.
But did you have any idea what Zed Special or
No
idea.
No, you weren't told.
You weren't told.
No.
So what was your first inkling, the first indication it might be something pretty violent?
I was sick and tired for years of training other people and have them say to me, no, you're required here. They couldn't stop me joining Zed Special.
Right. When, though, did you first find out that it meant highly dangerous, hazardous occupation? There must have been an indication fairly early on. This was something really different, were going to be trained in particular skills.
Yeah.
When did that become apparent?
We were sent from Melbourne to Fraser Island. Fraser Island, no one was allowed on that island except Zed Special. And we were specifically trained there. And then we had to go to other areas for specialised training.
I've seen the documentary on ABC television and I've seen some of the things you did. Let's just go through some of the aspects of the training, because they are quite remarkable. For a start, you had to become a specialist in a wide range of weaponry. Yes. What sort of weapons did you train on?
Everything. Yeah. From submachine guns, explosives. I'd been in the army a few years, and it was the most training I'd ever done in all these things. Normally, as a medic, that was your job. But I was not only a medic, I had to learn everything about weaponry, explosives, everything.
You also had to learn unarmed combat.
Yep.
Take me through that. What sort of techniques did you learn?
Well, you were taught how to kill people quietly, etc., etc. Again, it was just something that maybe you may be required to do. I had more training in every variety you'd require in the army in Z.
Yes. Because you also had to learn languages. Now, you had to learn another language, at least one more language, did you not?
Yeah. We were taught to speak Malay. It depends on where they wanted you to go. You were asked, would you like to join with me? An English army officer came up to me on Fraser Island and he said, I'm putting together a group for a job. I'd like you to join my group. And you weren't allowed to say, well, what is it? Where is it? What's it about? You just said either yes or no. Once you said yes, there were seven of us chosen. And we then trained as a group.
So you joined a special group, and I think we want to make something clear very early on to anyone who gets a bit confused about the titles, because you're Z Special. There was another force called Z Force, and you get a bit angry when the two are confused. Let's get them clear, shall we?
Z Force. Now you're testing my memory.
I thought that was a British force.
It was. Yeah. And it was a failed British course. And we were a bit worried that we'd be connected to that. But no, as you said, Special was asked by the governor of the day that the Australian government required a group of people to do special jobs.
Yes.
That's how Z Special was formed.
Sure. So, weaponry, unarmed combat, languages. A fascinating aspect of the training as well was surveillance. You had to learn a bit of spying, a bit of observation.
Yeah.
What were those techniques?
Well, we went down to Melbourne and we were given assignments to follow people, etc., etc., and you went. We were there for probably a month, just learning whatever we could. It was pretty full on.
Yes, because you also learned sabotage, I understand.
Yeah. We had to learn how to use explosives, etc., etc. Yeah.
And then living off the land, becoming totally self-sufficient, surviving in the most difficult conditions.
Well, we had to do that when we first, and on the first job we were chosen. We were dropped into Borneo and we took no food. We just had to rely on what the people of Borneo up in the highlands gave us, and it was rice, breakfast, dinner and tea and whatever else you could find.
Well, let's go through that remarkable journey, how you got to Borneo. You'd been training for a year or so?
I'd say yes, very close to a year, just training for that one particular job.
Incredibly fit
and
ready
last,
to go.
Yeah. The last part of the training was we were just told, right, next week we go to Sydney. Why Sydney? We've got to learn, teach you how to jump out of aeroplanes. And of course, everyone's only one out of the seven of us refused to jump. So he was quietly left aside and used on other operations. But it was pretty full on, I can assure you.
So let us go back now to this flight to Borneo. What sort of aircraft was it? Tell us about, describe the scene.
We flew from Queensland to what's the island outside of just outside of Borneo. We had two B-24s,
yes.
Which we jumped out of. You went out of what used to be the camera hatch in the middle of the floor. You dropped through. We flew over two days looking for a DZ. We found what we thought was an excellent DZ on the second day, and the third day we jumped in there. It was a blind jump. We didn't know whether the Japs had penetrated the highlands or not. Luckily, they hadn't. They'd been up there, but just to have a look around, etc., for themselves. But they never stationed any Japanese up in the highlands.
So you had the order to jump. Was it day or night? A day or night?
It was. It was 8:30 in the morning,
right.
And it was the biggest mistake we ever made, because on the day we saw the old longhouse and the paddy fields, we thought that's the perfect DZ. It was 12:30 in the day. When we flew up at 8 o'clock in the morning, all we could find was cloud, mist, and we couldn't see the ground. And the pilot flew around in a circle three or four times until Harrison, our party leader, got on the intercom and said, "Listen, next time around, drop your wares you think it is." Consequently, we dropped about 5 miles away from the DZ in the middle of the jungle.
So you
we landed in, you know, 20, 30 feet high trees.
And you were one of several operatives dropped at this, for this particular action?
Four out of each plane.
Now, I think it's pretty important to tell us what you were carrying. You were carrying grenades, I believe.
Yeah, well, I had a American carbine, which was half the size of our 303s, but in jungle warfare were perfect. I had a revolver in a shoulder holster, and I had three grenades in a pouch on my chest, and away we went.
Something else you had as well, I believe, a cyanide pill.
Yep. Before we, just before we boarded the plane, we were handed this pill. And we, "What's this for?" And we were told it was a cyanide pill. "What the hell for?" "Well, if you look like getting caught by the Japanese, you can use it." I didn't like the idea of that. And when I looked down and we came through the clouds and I saw what we were going to land in, I was very close to another one of the group, and I called out to him. I said, I'm not going into those trees with this thing in my mouth. So I spat it out.
Yes. There was a danger that the rough landing dislodged it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I did not. I'd sooner die by a bullet than bite into a poison pill.
So your task was to train an army, your own army, effectively, of warriors from the highlands of Borneo.
Yeah, yeah. My second day, Harrison came to me and he said, Snow, there's an old chap in the quarters, can't walk. Go and see what you can do for him. So I went in and asked him. He had a jawat on, a length of cloth, and he pointed to his groin, and I thought, oh, well. So I slightly pushed the jawat aside, and he had a golf ball-sized lump in his groin. And I looked at it, and I thought, there's some pus in there that's wanting to get out. So I got two of the other fellas, and I had no anaesthetic, and I said, you hold his arms and shoulders, you hold his feet, and I said to the old guy, this may hurt a little, but I lanced it, and as soon as I lanced it, pus spurted everywhere, so I'd expressed everything I could out of it, and said to him, I'll see you tomorrow morning and I'll dress it again. About 10 o'clock the next morning, Penghulu Miri, the head man of all the Kalabit people, arrived, and evidently the old guy had been talking to him, because he came up to me with Harrison and he said to Harrison, would your doctor visit all my kampongs? And I promptly said, oi, I'm not a doctor, I'm a medic. But to them, I was their doctor. And from that day to the day I left Borneo, I was Tuan Doc.
Tuan Doc, I like that very much.
Yeah.
These people are famous people. They, described them as the Kalabat. Are they also the Iban, the two terms?
Oh, yeah. There were Kalabats, Ibans, yep. Musaks, very different tribes.
Were they all headhunters, or was that just a piece of fiction?
No, most of them were. I think the probably the worst one were probably the Ibans. Mm-hmm. They liked nothing else but, as a matter of fact, the first job I did against a group of Japanese, they came back carrying four heads, and I didn't know what to do. I said, you're not getting in my boat with them, you get into the back boat. It was their way of life. And we wanted them on our side. And frankly, they were on our side from the first day they met us. They were wonderful people.
Had they been badly treated by the Japanese? Had
Yes, they had. Yeah. All the Japanese took everything they could offer them. Took their rice. They might have 6 months' rice stored up. The Japs would take the lot. Any arguments, bang.
I'm sure that Tuan Doc fixed all the relations. That was an important thing. I can see that. It's a fact also, is it not, Jack, that when they fought with blowpipes and poison arrows?
Blowpipes, parangs.
Oh, parang, yes. Big knife, yes.
There's one out there I can show you. It wasn't probably 2 months before we'd got enough airdrops in of arms and we could hand them over to one of our sergeants who was stationed at headquarters all the time, that taught them how to use a gun. But the fact that they were so good with their blowpipes, they took to sighting a rifle very quickly.
And then you got to a stage where you were leading groups of them on guerrilla, in guerrilla warfare against the Japanese.
Oh yes, yeah. That was our job from 5 weeks, end of 5 weeks. On the third day, I'd left headquarters with from orders from Harrison and the Pangulu to visit all his tribes. It took me 5 weeks, and all I was doing was treating them for whatever was wrong. They'd had no medicines, anything. The Japs given them nothing for 5 years, so they were a pretty poor lot, and some of them had so bad ulcers on legs I'd have to give them 3 injections, intravenous injections, a week apart, and I'd say to them, well, you'll have to come with me. And I had those people stay with me right then, and even after they healed, they wanted to fight the Japanese with me.
Now, this was, because you dropped into the region in March 45, very big Japanese force there late in the war. You led these groups of, I suppose we should call them resistance fighters, really, these fighters serving under you.
Yeah, well, they hated the Japanese. So you had to be very careful, because they were not frightened of anything. And any of my guys to get killed. But I never lost one in all the time I was there. So, and we notched up quite a few.
It was a question really of restraining their enthusiasm for an all-out fight, was it?
Yeah. They'd have taken out a parang and rushed straight at them. I had to get that out of them very quick, smart. But no, they gradually found out what they didn't, what their Chuan said was what they had to do.
What sort of tactics did you train them in then?
Well, actually, 90% of our jobs, we would know 24 hours that there's a group of Japanese coming inland on such and such a track, and there's no such thing as roads over there even today. There's one road going up into Berrio even today. But it was very easy to set up an ambush on a narrow track. The Japs, there'd be 15 to 20 of them. They'd have tail end Charlie and one at the back and one at the front. So we'd always kill the one on the back first. And then my other boys, either side of the track, would open up on them.
Yes.
It was the easiest method you could have. We could be 4 feet away from them in the jungle and they wouldn't know we were there.
So what sort of weapons would they open up with?
The Japanese.
No, your side, your troops.
Well, by then, we had mostly 3 or 3s for not all of them. Some of them preferred their parangs. That's what they used.
And did they use the blowpipes as well?
Oh, yes, yeah. But you've got to remember, once the blowpipe dart hit them, they could still, for probably a few minutes before the poison would take effect. So I preferred a lot of them not to use their blowpipes when we were taking out a small group of Japs.
The figures from the performance of said special were quite incredible. I have a record here that says said special accounted for more than 1,800, nearly 2,000 of the enemy, while losing 129 commandos themselves. They trained more than 6,000 guerrilla fighters. An incredible record.
Yeah, it was. Mainly because they all wanted to kill the Japanese. In my case, I had just about 28 that fought with me right to the third week in October. I preferred, I checked them all over. You married? You got children? Yes. Yeah. No. I stuck with 20-year-olds wherever I could, because it's not so bad if there's just one of them, but if he's married and he's got a family, in my mind, no, I'd prefer the other way. And it worked.
Can you recount, can you recall how many ambushes, how many sorties, how many ops you actually went on?
I know overall the 7 of us accounted for just over 2,900 Japanese. I know that my group alone, we at one stage were up to 129 of Japanese. We weren't counting. Once you'd killed off a group of Japanese, I'd always say to them, get the bodies well into the jungle, away from tracks, scuff up any blood stains, anything, because after I'd passed on, maybe another Jap patrol would come up and they'd see something and they'd take it out on the people.
Reprisals.
Yeah, so you had to be very careful on that type of thing.
Did you receive any particular orders about taking prisoners?
No. We just couldn't take a prisoner. What were we going to do with them? So it was just a case of if you were taking out a patrol, you took out everyone.
Now, you referred earlier to an operation that took place in October. Japan surrendered on the 15th of August, 1945, yeah. But you didn't know about that, did you?
No. By that time, I was over in the other side of Borneo, and I got a message from Harrison saying, the war's over, Treadway, get out the best way you can. So I just looked at my map and a week's walk around there. Tarakan's 11 miles across the sea there, so they paddled me in a big prow across to Tarakan. And the CO of the island, I reported to him, and he said, I was told to expect some of you people. He said, you've got priority one back to Australia.
Right.
And I spent 10 days waiting for priority one and didn't get it. So I went to the CL and I said, hey, when are they going to get moved on? And he said, look, I'm having trouble getting you on a boat. He said, there's a plane going to it'll come to me. Molino.
That's all right.
Yeah. I'll put you on that. So I went on that. They flew me over to headquarters on this island. And within 2 days, I was on another plane back home to Australia.
So you'd been on active service, the most dangerous sort of active service, up against a well-equipped enemy for the second half of August, after Japan had officially surrendered, right through September into October. You were still fighting.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know it was over.
No.
How did the message get to you then in the end? You said that...
A runner,
yeah, yes.
Yeah.
So what had happened to your radio?
That went in the drink. One of the rivers, we were shooting to some rapids, and away it went. So all my messages came from Harrison by runners.
And you believed it was over, did you? Mm-hmm. You actually believed it was over?
Well, yes. I knew Harrison's writing, etc. Oh, and that suited me. A very arrogant man. What he said... It was law. That is, if you took notice of him. But it was always, yes, sir, go your own way. And that's what you did. An Australian didn't take much notice of a pommy in those days, I can tell you. And yet, if I ask him for... certain things to do with attacking, etc., etc., never argued. So he worked out quite well that way.
Yeah. You respected him as a soldier. You respected him as a soldier.
Yeah. But he was not used to handling Australians. No. So, but he learned fairly quickly.
So
we were all so independent. I mean, when you live on your own with 30 native people, they become your family, and they treated you with the greatest respect, and you did the same thing for them. I only lost 2 men out of my 30 that were killed. I had a few minor injuries, etc., but all in all, we did pretty well.
2 fatalities.
Yeah.
2 killed in action.
Yeah.
Jack, you flew back to Australia. You explained the circumstances. You flew back. Where did you set foot back in Australia? Where did you come to at the end of the war?
They dropped us off in Northern Territory.
Yeah.
And we came by train then all the way through back to Melbourne.
Right.
So, Melbourne, we were taken to headquarters in Melbourne, where they spent a week debriefing you on what had been done and how it was done, where, etc., etc. And then they made you sign a document that forbid you from talking about what you did for 30 years. That was to protect you, because you couldn't take prisoners.
Yes, I understand. Then you came back to Adelaide.
Yep.
And you had another sort of debriefing, a medical debriefing, because you had a few things wrong with you, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you had no hope of not getting him.
Malaria.
I'd been getting attacks off and on, and but I got home to Adelaide, and I was home about a week when I finished up at Dawes Road. And I was in and out of Dawes Road, and
I believe the repatriation hospital there had to treat you for hookworm.
Yep.
Amoebic dysentery.
Yeah. But they fixed me up.
Fixed you up. And there was formal recognition of your magnificent service. You found out for a start you'd been promoted, I believe.
Yep. I'd gone in as a sergeant. And Melbourne told me, of course, you know, you were promoted to World War II. And I said, no. And he said, well, you were. And I said, good, I hope the salary was increased. He looked at me and laughed. No.
And there was further recognition with the award of the Military Medal. I'd just like to quote from the citation. And it said, it refers to you in that as Sergeant Treadray, and it acknowledges the way that you established an intelligence network throughout Sarawak and Borneo. You showed remarkable energy, unselfishness, and devotion to duty. It refers especially to, on one occasion, during these engagements, he led seven natives armed with submachine guns in a direct attack on a Japanese heavy machine gun, which was silenced and all six of the enemy killed at the post.
Well, I think I've got that out there. You had to do so much that you never gave a thought to how dangerous it was or anything. You knew that if you didn't get them, they'd get you. So, no. Mind you, I'd take great care on that type of job, because I always carried a few grenades. And the first thing I'd do would be to toss a grenade at them, and as soon as that explode, then you'd go at them. They were too busy worrying about the grenade to concentrate on you. You worked out your own ways.
The contrast then, you were discharged from the army in March 46. You went back to civilian life.
Yeah. I went back to Flair & Co., my old job.
Yes.
Mr. Shahinga, Dolph Shahinga, came. I was in Dawes Road, and he came out. He lived at Mitcham, and he came in to see me one day. Now, Jack, he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And he looked at me and he said, I want you to come back and offside me. He said, you know, Mr. Flair died in 41. And I said, yes. And he said, well, I bought all the Flair...
the holdings?
Yeah, all their holdings. And I want you alongside me. I'll teach you cutting, fitting, everything. And so I said, all right. As soon as I'm fit again, I'll come back. And it worked out wonderfully. Because we worked together for 4 or 5 years. And one day he didn't arrive at work. And the phone went, and it was his wife. She said, Jack, she said, Dolph won't be in for a few days. I'm getting the doctor to him. I thought, all right. So I looked at the cutting book and I thought, well, I better get these things cut. Mm. And from then onwards, instead of him coming into work at 9 o'clock, he might arrive at 10 or 11 because he always knew that I was there. Yeah. But that's how he taught me, and it worked.
And then eventually, some years later, you took over the business yourself?
Yeah. When he died, I made arrangements with his wife that I'd buy all his shares, but I couldn't pay for them all at once. So I said, if you're agreeable, I'll pay you so much money every month. Yes. And that's how I bought the business.
So what period was that, Jack? What year was that? Can you remember? 1950s,
60s? Yeah, it would have been... '46. Yeah, it would have been 5-6 years that I worked with him, learning everything I could.
Did you keep, when you took over the business, did you keep the old name going?
Or oh, yes,
you...
yeah. It was still Flair and Company.
Flair and Company, yes.
Yeah.
With some very distinguished customers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Especially...
We had all the top people in Adelaide, doctors, dentists, businessmen. I made for 5 of South Australia governors. And we had a wonderful clientele.
Such a peaceful existence, it seems. So dignified, so ordered compared with what you had been doing. Were there difficulties, though, in making this adjustment to civilian life for you?
No, because the 30-year silence helped us. Because we didn't talk about it. My customers knew I'd been in the army, and they knew from newspaper article that I'd been awarded, and it made things easier for me because of my history throughout my life in the firm.
So if someone said to you, what do you do in the war, Jack? What did you say back in those days?
Well, whenever they'd say, ask me what I did during the war, I'd say, well, I was in a special unit and we weren't allowed to discuss it. And they'd accept it. And when it did come out in the end, it caused quite a bit of chatter then.
You're a man walking the streets, possessed of quite remarkable skills. Were you ever tempted to use them if you saw a civilian disturbance or a lout behaving badly, were you ever tempted to give him a kick or a hit with the heel of your hand?
No. I never. Well, I still don't. I never drank alcohol or anything in my life. So I was always pretty focused on what I wanted to be, where I wanted to get in the business. And I knew, with the type of people that I was dealing with, that I had to maintain a certain way of life. And I did.
You married, you had a family. Talk me through that.
Yes, I got married and I had two daughters. My older daughter, she died of cancer at 52, but my younger daughter, she's still looking after me.
Now, what I do happen to know as well, and I think this is the most enriching part of an extraordinary life, you developed this remarkable relationship, the rapport with the people in Borneo, based in particular at the township of Barrio, I believe. And you've been back there a number of times after the war. Mm-hmm. What have you done for the people up there?
Well, I've been back 7 times, all told. I went back in 93 and two of us, myself and another guy, saw this business in Kuching, and we noticed an advertisement about a plane going up to Barrio. So I said, let's check this out. Yes, this plane goes up every morning. Oh, so I looked at him and he said, I think we'll go up. So I went up and it was, I could only fly up that morning, and about 2 hours later I had to get back on the plane to come back to Kuching because I was booked to come back to Australia. But it made me want to go back again. And luckily, 2010, Channel 7 wanted to do a documentary up there. So they took me and said, did I want to bring anyone with me? So I took one of my granddaughters and let her see, things. And that documentary went to air here. And then I found out then that there was a few things that perhaps I could help them with. So I went back in 2013 and I took 54 medals, sets of two medals, Australian War Medal and the other one.
A Pacific Star.
That's right. Yeah. And I presented my old fighters with their medals. And they're still wearing them today, believe me. Those that are alive. But then you gradually see other things you could do. So I got them medical chests, took a suitcase full of books back. They're in the library up there, Jack Treadway's section. And all in all, I've been able to do a few things for them, which I didn't mind. Because, believe you me, I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for my 30 fighters.
Exactly. Thank you. Great honour talking to you. Just to finally reflect on your remarkable life and times. A lot of people come back from the war in a bad way, haunted by memories, post-traumatic stress. You seem to be at peace with yourself. How are you in that regard?
I had 10 weeks in various hospitals in Adelaide before discharge, and I went back to my old job. I worked for 55 years and I missed 1.5 days work in that entire time. So health wise I was extremely lucky. For a few years I'd get recurrent small malaria attacks and that type of thing, but I never let it beat me. And once I retired, then things started to go a bit wrong. I had a triple bypass in 93. Couple of years later, I had both knees replaced. Couple of years after that, I had both hips replaced. And look at me.
I saw you marching last Anzac Day. You look pretty good.
I haven't missed an Anzac Day since 1947.
And in your mind and in your dreams, are you at peace? Do you reflect on those days? Do they trouble you? What are your sensations, your sentiments, looking back on this extraordinarily dangerous and challenging war?
I never thought of it. Having joined the army at 18, I accepted all my army career as part of life, and I never dwelt upon it. My main thing was always to get better, improve myself, and I got as far as a woe too. But no, I enjoyed every minute of my army career. But when we had to sign the 30-year deal, you put it out of your mind, and that's how I lived. I started off afresh, and I live for my family, my work, and so forth. And I've never regretted it.